Daily news, breaking updates, and exclusive podcasts. iTricks.com.
This is the iTricks.com Magic Stars podcast for the week ending March 11th, 2010. I'm Justin Robert Young. Coming up a little later in the podcast, we have Mike Weatherford, he of the Las Vegas Review-Journal, who wrote maybe one of the best investigative stories on a magic act I've read in a very, very, very long time. We'll talk all about it. The inside scoop on the Scarlet debacle. Coming up a little later, but first, the news. Jonathan Pendragon pled no contest this week as part of a plea deal with authorities, according to the Santa Maria Times. Pendragon will be sentenced to a year in jail on April 13th and will serve his time at the San Luis Obispo County Jail. He will also serve up to 5 years of probation and is charged with 2 strikes on his record. His lawyer was surprised Pendragon decided to change his mind and plead instead of fighting the charges, which was his initial stance. Says Pendragon's attorney, Ilan Funke Bilou, he didn't know why his client chose to change his plea and not proceed to trial, but he assumed that it had something to do with his feelings for his wife. She was present in court on Tuesday, Charlotte was, when her husband of 33 years apologized for her and any harm he may have caused her. To be honest, we hope this is the last that we talk about this Pendragon's case, but everybody here at iTrix wishes all parties the best possible outcome. Criss Angel made his long-scheduled appearance on Raw this week, although anyone hoping for a big illusion within the square WWE circle might have been a little bit disappointed. Criss performed 3 backstage segments, but played it straight before the main event when he announced the entrances of John Cena and Vincent Kennedy McMahon, the CEO of WWE. In the first backstage segment, Angel performed Wayne Houchin's thread. In the second, he read the mind of an underrated veteran heel, William Regal. And in the third, he performed a smash and stab, which, considering that particular effect's dodgy success rate, might have been a big enough risk to take for live television. If you would like to register what you thought, head on over to iTricks to, let's see what the post is called, final scorecard for Criss Angel's Raw appearance, and let us know. How does a young woman deal with a mostly male fraternity of magic? Kristen Lambert tells Wayne Kawamoto about the challenges and unique issues facing ladies in the industry. For example, mentorship. Quoth Kristen, currently there are a few women in magic who we can look up to. It's easy for males to find role models, but we can only share those to a certain extent. I can admire Matt King for his character skill and knowledge, but he's not exactly one that would consider a feminine performer as I need to be. One of the early mentors suggested that I do my ring routine in black slacks and a black blouse. Well, maybe it could have had a bit of sparkle, he said. Lambert appears to be a thoroughly modern woman, with interests and goals beyond thumb tips and forces, what with her vlogging and twittering and all. Our sense is that it takes a mind that is not 110% dominated with magic to truly analyze the faults and failings of our industry and make the appropriate corrections. We hope to hear more and see more of Lambert as time goes on. Press, for any magician, is a rare and important opportunity. You only get so many bites of the apple, and the results will live among your clippings forever. So when Steve Cohen found out that he was going to be profiled by the New York Times, we are assuming he racked his brain to figure out a very personal effect that would fry the writer. And then he did it. Now I'm going to read directly from the Times story so you guys can get a feeling of what he did. He told me to come down to Riverside Park at 72nd Street just before sunset. Quote, that's when wishes come true. In a tailored suit, he has red hair, balanced features, and a mellow disposition. Around us, people walk dogs. On a small pad, Mr. Cohen drew a circle to represent a wishing well. He gave it to me and told me to write a wish inside the circle, tear off the paper, and put it in my pocket. I wrote, travel the Appalachian Trail. We walked toward the river. Moses had the Red Sea, Cohen said. I have the Hudson River. When we got there, he dug out a quarter, scrawled his initials on it, and asked me to write mine, along with a symbol. He told me to toss the coin in the river. Leveling his gaze, he had me fixate on my wish. He mentioned something That had to do with travel, a politician, Tennessee. Then he said, travel the Appalachian Trail. He said, my lucky coin can make my wish come true. Too bad, he reminded me, it lay at the bottom of the Hudson. He then clenched his right hand into a fist. Water seeped from it. He opened his hand, and there was the coin, wet. Boom. The full article, which ran in the Sunday edition of the New York Times, is fantastic. Find the link on iTrix or just search the New York Times website at nytimes.com for Cohen. And one quick bit involving David Blaine. If you missed the new NBC show, The Marriage Ref, last Thursday, then head on over to iTrix and see a little cameo that our boy did while a couple was arguing about whether or not the wife should be able to floss in bed. The husband won the argument, according to a panel consisting of Tina Fey, Jerry Seinfeld, and Eva Longoria. But the solution was a comical introduction and gift, rather, of a David Blaine plasticite box where the wife could do whatever she wanted, no matter how graphic and gross and dental-related. So, funny thing is, inside the box is Blaine eating a piece of pizza and reading William Kalush's book, Houdini. Check it out. Clips on iTrix. And now for our newsmaker interview. As you guys are going to find out, I really, 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 really like the Las Vegas Review-Journal story on Scarlett and the behind-the-scenes tales of how her two shows came together, fell apart, and what the ramifications are now. We spoke with the author, Mike Weatherford, columnist and reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. He spoke to us from the newsroom of said paper. Joining me on the phone right now is a reporter and columnist for the Las Vegas Review-Journal and a friend of the site, Mike Weatherford. Thank you very much for joining us on the Magic Stars podcast. Mike.
Good to talk to you.
Now, you're on to discuss what I would say, and obviously it's a rarity in the magic industry that, you know, investigative journalism pops up at all, let alone to the quality of the article that you wrote about Scarlett this week. But it really just kind of hit me for a loop in terms of the kind of stuff you got. So first and foremost, congratulations.
Well, thanks. You know, it was about magic. I think the kind of show that this sort of thing, I guess in a big picture, a lot of the story deals with the availability of these rent-the-room venues and the fact that almost anybody can walk in and try their luck at having a show. And perhaps more of those tend to be magic because, you know, as I'm sure the cliche is, right, the magic's the only thing you can buy your way into.
Yeah. Well, and certainly there is something to be said about that. And this is a story about a magic show, but more specifically, it's about some just really fascinating personalities when you put them all together. If you're unfamiliar with the story, number one, first and foremost, if you have not read this story, stop this podcast immediately. We'll have the link up on iTrix. Go to the Las Vegas Review-Journal website and search Scarlett. It is a great read. You'll burn through it in seconds. But now that you're back, all right, if you've paused it and now you've come back having read the story, let me just get to the stuff that I found the most fascinating that I didn't necessarily know. First, I think people might be confused at exactly how young Scarlett is. At the time that she first met with the man that would become her producer and manager, she was in high school.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. He contacted a dance school in Reno looking for a magician's assistant and found her that way. He meaning John Lewis again.
John Lewis.
Those
yeah.
who didn't bother to pause and go read the whole thing had retired to Reno, and I guess he thought his retirement career would be kind of the small trade circuit of performing at the Elks Lodges and whatnot, and he hired her as his assistant. And then after a while, and who knows really how all this went in the timeline, but at some point he decided people would rather see her than a 67-year-old guy up there doing this stuff.
Yeah. And here's the other part that was fascinating to me. Number one, and this is, I mean, inside the industry, obviously you talk to people, Scarlett, you know, after the arrest for domestic violence, when she beat up John and the cops were called and everything, people talk in the industry, and obviously there's much more that I hear that I can necessarily can't put up on the site. But even I and other people who followed and were interested in this story didn't know that John had a wife and still has a wife that he's now back with.
And that floored me as well. And that didn't come out till maybe second or third conversation I had with him about this.
Yeah. It is mind blowing. So, all right, here, let me just go back in time. Rewind a little bit. How do you kind of get on this story and how does it evolve? And when do you know that this is something that was bigger than just your kind of gossip item of a follow-up on this, on Scarlett as a performer and the failed show?
Well, first of all, you know, a week or so after she was arrested, we had a short version of the story that was more the bare bones, newsy kind of story, just pulled from the police report, because I'm sure it will shock you and people on this website that magicians tend to be a loose-lipped bunch.
If it weren't for that, yeah, we wouldn't have a site.
Right. few days after the arrest, that got back to me that had kind of spread in the community here. So we had the basic cut and dry version of it. And I had actually thought about trying to call him after that. And I thought, well, I think I'll let things cool off. And I don't know if I just chickened out or what, but I thought, you know, you move on, you do your other stuff. You know, I've got all these things I have to do every week. And I kind of forgot about it. But then, lo and behold, I had a letter in my mailbox, and it was a copy of a letter he sent to the Henderson Police Department, complete with photos, including the one that we ran on the front page today. And I thought, boy, if that's not an invitation to call him, what is? And so I called him.
Yeah.
And,
now this, you know, this photo, and you can see on the Review Journal website, is this picture of John Lewis, massive black eye, and he appears to be randomly shirtless as well.
Yeah, well, the other photos, that's, I guess, the other photos are the ones that the police took to document the bite marks and various other damage to him. So I think that's why he was shirtless.
Okay, there we go. Yeah. So you call him, and
so
how does
I
it go
I call him,
from
and
there?
We talk a few times, and he's actually all for writing more and for even running the photos. You know, I mean, one could have assumed that he wouldn't have sent them to me if he didn't want them to end up in the paper, but I didn't want to leave room for that mistake. And so I kept saying, you sure you'd be okay if we ran this? And so off and on, when I wasn't working on other things, I would talk to him. And the whole thing I thought I was moving toward was how to get this in the paper. And to do that, I kind of needed two things. I needed to reach her and at least give her an opportunity to talk, because otherwise it just, you know, that's not the rules we play by. And, you know, and if I reach her and she won't talk, that's one thing. But I had to reach her, and so that's one thing we were waiting for. The other thing was, like, what is going to make this relevant again? And he had been telling me, well, there's going to be more charges against her. And originally he was saying criminal charges, that he was trying to pursue another criminal arrest for forgeries and for, you know, the conversion of these assets and documents that were in his wife's name. So I was kind of working on toward that, and eventually kind of both things happened, although the court action turned out to be the civil suit, but still that kind of gave us protection as a newspaper to run his allegations, and it kind of it gave it, you know, a peg to hang it all on, you know, the hook to hang your hat on. And then I reached her through Facebook. I reached out, found out she
had a
Facebook page.
And who said print media can't socially network, huh?
There you go. And lo and behold, she called. And it was actually before the suit was filed, but still, you know, as you can read in the story, she has her version of the events and he has his, and I was happy to get them both in there.
Yeah, they are kind of in a nutshell. The number one, there was a pattern of a physical and verbal abuse between Scarlett and John, and you know, just some of the stuff that, you know, I'm quoting from your story here. He claims that she would pound holes in the drywall or dents in the kitchen stainless steel refrigerator. Another time, she locked herself in the bathroom with a knife, punched holes in the wall, and cut her leg, which seems to me that kind of stuff should be, you know, reasonably provable, right? If you're leaving this, you know, kind of physical damage in somebody's kitchen.
Yeah, that, well, and yet, you know, you can read her side of it, too. She denied all except the actual night of the arrest, and that she already pleaded no contest to.
Yeah.
And she basically denied anything beyond that.
Now, the other element of it is this forgery. Charge that there were private show cars and property that is now being claimed by John and his wife that she forged the wife's signature to get money to fund her show, both at the V Theater and at the Riviera, right?
And that part of it, it's fine if he says that, but that is the part where, you know, our newspaper's attorney that vets all this stuff might have had a problem with that if there hadn't been an arrest or the civil filing. But, and now we're reporting the fact that he claims this.
That he claims this. Okay.
Yeah, or the couple, he and his wife, claim this.
Which, just to go back to the big revelatory point for me, is that he has a wife that he's now back with. And this is
that
really
surprised me too. I'm pretty sure I almost dropped the phone when he told me that. And then, eventually, you know, I got her on the phone as well.
Yeah. And that's, you know, it's a testament to you as a reporter and an interviewer that you were able to get the kind of candor that you did out of all three of them. But I think specifically the wife, who would seem to be the most, you know, I guess, subject to maybe embarrassment talking about something like this. But there is a point before they move out to Vegas when Carolyn Lewis, and again, I'm quoting from the story, says they began grabbing, hugging. She was popping him on the rear with a scarf, and she was being very forward. She says that you could tell that neither of them wanted anything to do with me. You can't stay in a place when you think that you're not wanted. This is, I mean, this is insane stuff. I mean, when you're getting all this, you know, how much do you want to put in there as a reviewer or sorry, as a reporter, knowing that this is obviously just juicy human drama? How much do you push this?
We actually put most of it in. And I guess there's a logic to why she became available, too. If you actually read the court filing and what they're seeking and all that, she's pretty clearly the victim in this, or the one that the undisputed victim, I should say, because with the other two, you could take one side or the other and say, well, you know, they kind of got what they deserved. If he was, leaving his wife for a younger woman, he got his comeuppance, or you could say, you know, she clearly had no talent, no business doing this show. And if he was a fool to waste all his money on her, look what happened. You can make all those arguments, but then the wife clearly came out on the bad end of it, no matter how you see it, if they were
absolutely
spending not only his money, but hers.
Yeah. And this is, you know, a man who was certainly older than Scarlett, who brings in a girl who was, I guess at that point, fresh out of high school. Into their house, and then they wind up moving off to do this Vegas show together. And I guess correct me if I'm wrong, the crux of the financial legal argument is whether John signed over this money or if Scarlett forged Carolyn's name on this money to get this money for the show. Right.
I guess that's, you know, I mean, I don't want to try to speculate or do either attorney's job for them, but I guess that would be his. He and his wife would be trying to prove that she threatened or coerced him into converting these assets. And then her defense would probably be that, well, she wouldn't have known how to do it if it wasn't his idea and he hadn't helped her, you know. So I guess if this goes anywhere in court, those are the ways it could shape up.
Looking forward for Scarlett, in talking to her, do you think she has a future in Vegas? And if not, where might she go? Or where does she plan on going?
That's another weird part of all this is that, you know, as I pointed out in there, he says he actually wants her to continue and perform because that's his only way of making any money back from the thing. If she just hung it up and went to work at Starbucks or something, the whole investment would be down the drain. But so part of, and yes, what we had room for and what we didn't and all that, we kind of put, you know, the saucier stuff in at the expense of a lot of the mechanical side of it. And the suit is actually a breach of contract suit, and he is trying to prevent her from doing any magic work with this other company that they both signed at while the show was still at the Riviera. And a lot of that didn't make it into the story, but that's the essence of part of that filing.
Okay, so now the company that they both signed with at the Riviera, she is now working for without John's involvement.
Right.
Gotcha.
And they still claim they're going to rebound and come back with some new improved Scarlett show down the road.
And so, wait a minute. At the heart of this story is that he wants to still, or he is suing for the fact that he should still be her producer and therefore be making the money off any future Scarlett show.
Yeah, or at least get his cut of it.
At least get his cut.
Yeah.
And which, by the end of the story, she does pledge to do, that she will eventually pay him back.
Seems to be the plan.
Listen, folks, I mean, if you follow the Scarlett story at all, I suggest you read it. If you have not at all, I suggest you read it. But even, you know, stuff, you know, there are rumors that, I mean, have been floating around forever that, you know, she was, if not an alcoholic, somebody who depended on alcohol on a regular basis, would you get direct quotes from her about one of which I do just want to read real quick because it is one of those quotes. And, you know, as in the time that I spent as a reporter, you know, there are those things where you start writing it, you know, or typing on your computer, and you just know that that's just gonna look awesome when it hits the page. And this, I'm gonna speak for you, and correct me if I'm wrong. Is one of those quotes says Scarlett, her real name is, her last name is Jesse. I'm definitely not a drug addict. I did drink heavier, and I should or than I should have when I was in a relationship because I was not comfortable, and it was a kind of a way for me to cope. And this is the money quote. I wasn't an alcoholic, but I'd have a few drinks every night, which is just a fantastic quote. Mike, thank you very, very much for joining us.
I'd be curious how magicians react, because I'm always curious about how the, you know, rank and file journeyman magicians think about the ones that work here in Vegas. And so, you know, that kind of disconnect between any kind of actual talent and then that whole, you know, marketing side, and the fact that so many of the magic shows are the people that are kind of the chief cooks and bottle washers who go out and learn all the means of selling tickets and working with the timeshares and working with the brokers.
Yeah.
So I was curious about how you think this will kind of go down in the magic community.
Well, you know, Scarlett is an interesting case, only because, number one, and you can't really not factor this in, you know, the idea of the successful female magician is still an elusive one. You know, that there is an element where, you know, there have been a few here and there, and Melinda obviously would probably come to mind in Vegas as maybe the most prominent, if not, you know, the Luna Shamada maybe. But, you know, for every once in a while, you know, one comes in. She certainly came in with a little bit more of a fanfare. She was very young, and obviously she's attractive. But, you know, there are plenty of shows, I think, inside the magic community. I mean, there are plenty of shows in Vegas and otherwise that are people who maybe aren't, I'll say this in a very vanilla way, aren't exactly bringing anything new to the art. Are doing things that are kind of stock. And I think Scarlet might fall into that. And, you know, she admits herself, or her V show at the very least, suffered creatively for whatever reasons. I'm sure that there's finger pointing on why the show failed, as there is with any endeavor that doesn't go according to plan. But, you know, I don't know. I think that this story inside the community will probably play for people who have heard it or have known a little bit about it fantastically, because, you know, you get on the page in first person a lot of things that were just kind of whispered behind everybody's back before. So I would guess it would play, you know, in everybody that I've talked to, before I spoke to you. It's just, you know, wow, I can't believe not only is all this stuff out on Front Street, but, you know, stuff we didn't know, you know, like, yeah, well, big stuff, doing... like a wife.
When I was doing my regular work, you know, as the show reviewer, and I would see her show, and that just writing in that capacity allowed me to say, you know, she really didn't have any business being up there. But that's, like we said before, magic's the one place where you can attempt that if you go out and buy the props and buy the illusions. So I didn't know if that, like, aggravated the other magicians or not.
Well, you know, I think, of course, I mean, everybody's going to be jealous of the person who's on the stage, no matter what their relative talent level is. But, you know, it really is a double-edged sword, because on one hand, like, yeah, magic is something that where you can, with a sizable investment, get a lot of big illusions up on stage, and that kind of brings some intrinsic worth just by owning the equipment. But at the same time, magic's also a community that is not incredibly business smart a lot of times. And, you know, this is a grand example of that, even when somebody had the tools and, you know, the bank statement to put something in, it didn't exactly make them, you know, super smart on the balance sheet, not once, but twice. And, you know, I hope that Scarlet can put together a successful show, as I'd hope any magic show that opens up is not financially a failure. But let's say, theoretically, they don't learn the lessons of the first two times. There's not anything to say that this new company that's working with her directly won't make the same mistake.
Well, that's interesting what you said about the female magicians too, because yeah, I in the vast landscape outside of Vegas, there may be somebody like this, but here in town, I've never seen like a gender blind female magician who doesn't try to make something out of the fact, you know, that she's good looking and dresses sexy and stuff.
Yeah, and I think that there's an element of, if you are an attractive young woman, then, you know, why shouldn't you? You know, what there's,
right.
It would almost be silly not to, you know, do that. And I think in Scarlet's case, considering the kind of shape she's in and whatever her passions are to magic, I think she should by all means be up there and be, you know, appealing. And yeah, I think even from the male side, you know, I think it was, Chris Kenner that was talking at Magic Live a couple years ago, but talked about he'll get a lot of tapes of people that are sending in, you know, their routines and asking him for advice. And his first advice is, you know, get on a treadmill. So I think in general, maybe even women magicians are right to pay more attention about their physical appearance than male magicians are. I don't think that's necessarily the problem. The problem is, you know, putting together a compelling show, which is, again, a across-the-board problem. If you look at, you know, some of, let's say specifically, some of the shows that in the shallow economy in Vegas have not done well. And you know, if you know, can you name a show that's closed in Vegas that people weren't saying, well, you know, it wasn't that good of a show to begin with?
Yeah. Well, I mean, well, to answer the question, it go outside the magic realm, and there have been a couple, notably like the Second City, but in magic, yeah, especially, you know, the first time I reviewed the Scarlet show, it was just kind of convenient that Jeff McBride was trying to do something at the same time.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
So I did a combo review, and that made it super easy to write, just because, you know, here was this rank novice And then there's Jeff McBride, you know, just kind of a master.
Yeah.
And the fact is that both shows closed. So I guess that kind of proves your point. You know, I mean, to some degree, it doesn't, or proves one of their points. I don't know, to some degree, the talent doesn't have, has less to do than the marketing and the, where the venue is and all that stuff.
Yeah, and McBride is a guy who works, you know, a lot. You know, Scarlett, I don't know what Scarlett is doing right now beyond trying to get another Vegas show off. But, I mean, McBride, I don't think necessarily is hurting for places to go and perform, be it Vegas or otherwise, although I'm sure, you know, all things being equal, since he lives in Vegas, it wouldn't be horrible if, you know, he could roll out of bed and go do a show.
Right, I think that was the hope, yeah.
Anyhow, Mike, always fantastic talking to you. Again, congratulations. And again, everybody listening, it is LVRJ.com. Just search for Scarlett or go on iTricks and search for Scarlett. You'll be able to find the link there. But this is a must read. Mike, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, well, appreciate it. Thanks.
Mike Weatherford, listen, if it's going on in Vegas, that guy knows about it. Thank you very much, Mike, for joining us. David Copperfield's got a really easy schedule this week to memorize. He is off every single day until 1 week from now, the 18th of March, when he's back at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. And that about wraps it up for this edition of the Magic Stars Podcast. Thank you, everybody, for having the patience. We had to skip last week because we were doing the Andrew Main Lecture Tour, which, by the way, swings through Atlanta at the end of March. Look up at magiccomedyjam.com for more information on that. But in terms of our podcast, remember the Magic Week in Review, which we're going to be recording live from South by Southwest this weekend with Brian Brushwood and probably some other magic folks, depending on who we can wrangle. The email, of course, is show@itricks.com. If you want to follow all the iTrix news on Twitter, it is @itricks. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it is @JustinRYoung. But until next week, folks, for your old pal, Justin Robert Young, bang a gong.
iTricks.com.